You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This episode of See Here is sponsored by TR. Fuck the man.
Episode 11 of the See Here podcast. So grateful to have your company here. My name is Morris, and I am joined by Mr. Bernie Stickwell, Esquire.
Hello.
Mr. Tim Merrill. Well, he would be Esquire if he were of the Empire, but good evening, Tim.
Hey.
And joining us for the first time in a couple of episodes, we've missed her, Ms. Wendy Freeman.
Hey, your friend.
Welcome all. We're well truly into double figures now, so that's it. You know, this is no fly-by-night operation, this podcast. Before we sort of like go any further as to what we've been up to in recent times, we should say that the film that we're going to discuss this time around is Bernie's choice. It's Penelope Spheris's film of 1984 called Suburbia. So we'll be getting into that in a little while and finding out why Bernie picked this one and what our thoughts are. But let's do a quick round table as to things that we've been listening to or watching in recent weeks. And Wendy, it's been so long since we've spoken to you. It seems like an eternity. Wendy,
yeah.
What have you been up to?
Today, I just came in like fourth or fifth in a chili cook-off.
Oh,
it was really exciting.
Tell me it was out of 100 other
cooks. No, it was out of like 10, but I still won something. It was still fun, you know. But I made a smoky beef and bacon chili.
Mm-hmm.
I had experimented, Bernie, I'd experimented with making a vegan buffalo cauliflower chili, and that came out good.
Oh, man, I'd eat
that. Oh, wow. Are you going to send some of that to me?
Yes. Yeah, I'll wrap it up. Good. I'll put it in dry ice. That won't be expensive.
Excellent. Once we finish recording, I'll be sat by the front door with my knife and fork waiting for it to arrive.
but yeah, it went very well, and it was a comic shop, so the prize I won like a big hardcover book of Batman covers, and that was really nice, you know?
Oh, nice. So. That's awesome.
Yeah,
tell me, Wendy,
yeah.
How would it be, would you consider entering a vegan chili into a chili cook-off? Would you just be sort of laughed out of it, or?
No, because I mean it's generally pretty half and half with veggie chilies and so. So last year I made a lentil. It was a Thai lentil chili that I made last year, and it came out very good. I used like the red curry paste and lime juice and coconut milk and stuff, and it was so that actually placed well last year as well.
Wow.
So I like to experiment. I like making some very experimental chilies. So.
I've heard that about you, Wendy. I've heard you like to experiment, so.
I saw a movie that we will definitely be talking about at length at some point in time.
Oh, yeah.
Called Whiplash.
Whiplash. So it's, is that like a sequel to 50 Shades of Grey or something?
Well, it's much better because you got J.K. Simmons verbally abusing people, so.
No, his character really reminded me of Lee Ermey. In Full Metal Jacket, but I think that point's been made across the board. I will be immensely excited to be talking with you about this on the podcast sometime next year or whenever it is that you choose.
Well, whenever it's available for everybody to watch, we'll do that. So maybe
so
next year.
I heard basically this was the Buddy Rich story.
Well, if it was about Buddy Rich's kids, I guess, because it was. Now, Buddy Rich wasn't abused. He was the abuser.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. Like, but this guy, the character in the film, seems like he's like full on, like Buddy Rich was.
Yeah, he's pretty crazy town. He's pretty bonkers, but it's an interesting, it's funny, because as a music teacher, you know, I watched it, and I thought to myself two things. I thought, man, I really should have practiced harder in school. I wish my kids practiced harder. I wish my kids gave a shit about pleasing me.
There's plenty to discuss about this. I got into this discussion with one of my wife's friends after we came out of the cinema, and her interpretation of the ending of the film was completely different from mine. And I told her my interpretation, and she said, oh, I hadn't thought about it like that. No, it was completely obvious to me, but I'd be interested to see how many people sort of took her interpretation. And we obviously don't want to give anything away here, but yeah, anyway. I look forward to discussing that on the show next year. That's a given, and I'm looking forward to that coming out on Blu-ray. I think that'll be a definite buy for me. That's going to be a multi-watch film. And actually, my wife Joanne's been to see it twice.
Yeah, I never want to watch it again. I think it's amazing. I love it, but it upset me too much. I never want to watch it again.
So you won't need to refresh yourself for the podcast?
I'll take copious notes now while it's fresh, and then I'll hang on to those notes for a year.
Yeah, good on you. All right, let's go all throughout round the table. Bernie Sticky.
I just wanted to mention the new Pornographers LP. Brill?
Brill Busters.
Oh, God, Brill Busters.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to talk about it, but I don't know what it's called. Yeah, it's fantastic.
I've got to be honest. Great record, yeah.
I'm a complete latecomer to, I'm a newcomer to the new Pornographers.
Oh, wow.
Been aware of them. And
you've got a great back catalogue to go through.
That's going to be my project over the next couple of months, I think. But certainly the new LP is just fantastic. Winner after winner, really catchy, intelligent, sort of upbeat, slightly melancholic, sort of poppy songs, which with real kind of hooks that just drill into your head and just stay there.
Solo stuff too. I think AC Newman's solo stuff is great. I love him.
Yeah, it seems that is it Nico Case? She gets all the plaudits, but looking at all the songwriting credits on the album, it seems that AC Newman does most of the songwriting. So yeah, I'm definitely going to check out his solo stuff as well.
I'm sorry I missed out on the last tour that they had here, but my good friend Adam, who's been a huge fan of the Pornographers for many years. In fact, actually, when we met and we started out our band called The Shambles, that was the first song he sort of played to me. He said, we got to learn this song. And we did. The song was Laws of Change from their album Electric Version. We had this three part harmony power pop band, and I did the Nico Case bits, he did the AC Newman bits, but I'm obviously not as good looking as Nico Case is, but I think I sang her bits reasonably well.
It's all in the eye of the beholder, Morris,
and all in the ear of the beholder as well.
Well, yeah. But is there YouTube footage of you guys doing that, or
no? I don't think we have any. Oh, actually, so we do have a little bit of video footage. This was the whole start of our love of a cappella. I came up with this idea one day. I said to Adam, hey, how about a joke? I've just thought about us doing Bonzo Goes to Bitburg by the Ramones a cappella, and he shat himself laughing. He said he didn't like it. He said, no, I think that's the best idea you've ever had. So that was the one song in our repertoire, unfairly, I think, that got attention from everyone, that everyone stopped what they were doing to listen to us do Bonzo Goes to Bitburg. So I thought, we're onto something here. Maybe we ought to stop this power pop band thing and start an a cappella group instead. And that's But now what we're thinking of doing maybe is dropping the microphone and bringing out the drum kits and guitars and basses and piano and playing a song with instrumentation. What do you reckon? Will that work?
So now you're going to go all instrumental. Is that what you're telling us? You're going to go from being a cappella to being all instrumental?
Well, just for one song, you know, just for the novelty.
I think you'd clear the room, Morris. People are going to be there. Like, I didn't pay good money to see this. What are these guys playing at?
Oh dear, never mind. Anyway, so you're really digging the new Pornographers?
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's been on the turntable non-stop for the last month. I can't recommend it enough. Mm. One of my LPs of the year easily. So check it out.
It is a great album. I'm glad that you're on board. Glad that you're a fan.
Heck yeah! I kind of wish I hadn't. You know, it hadn't taken me this long to get on board. I should have been listening to them years ago. You know,
but
there you go. That's the beauty of music, isn't it? You're always discovering new things, coming late to things, and
Absolutely.
It's all there. So,
and now you can sort of like go through their entire back catalogue, and it's just going to be a wondrous journey. I mean, that's a wonderful thing, because you always sort of get to hear, you know, you hear about a band that everyone else has loved for ages, but you've now got that beautiful thing where you're discovering it for the first time, whereas all the old fans are just sort of, oh, yeah, we're used to that. They put out a great album a couple of years ago called Together, which I think a lot of their longtime fans were a bit lukewarm about.
Yeah,
I don't know why. I love it. I think it's just got great pop melodies, but maybe it helps that I've not sort of like been a long time fan. But
right. I mean, I love From Blown Speakers. That's my favorite album of theirs. But.
Right.
And speaking of bands that like coming to like late in the game, next week I'm going to go see Sloan.
That you recommended them to me.
Yes, yeah, I know. But I mean, like in the span of their lifetime, I came. So like, it's good. I still had a bunch of albums to catch up on, you know. But I'm very excited to go see Sloan next week. Really,
they've been around since like the, is it like the early 90s, I think?
Yes, yeah.
Wow, it's like 20 years worth to catch up on. That's great.
Well, we had a CD shop that was closing down in town, I think earlier on this year, and they were getting rid of it, you know, like everything for $5 each. And I picked up a bunch of things, and one of them was there's like a compilation called A-Sides and More or something like that. But the beauty was it also had a DVD of all their film clips. And in the extras, it had a selection of the band members talking about every one of the clips. So it's a really great little package that. So excellent. So when are you going to see them, Wendy?
Next Sunday, a week from today.
We expect a report. All
right, yeah.
Tim.
Yeah.
What's shaking?
Oh, well, I just, this afternoon, I went and saw the magnum opus known as Interstellar.
Oh, yeah.
The Chris Nolan film. And the one which he basically tries to get the entire population of Earth off the planet. So he creates a wormhole in space with his anus and disappears up his own ass. No, I don't know. It was, you know, it's 3 hours and, you know, it looks pretty and everything. And a lot of people are, you know, bestowing the adoration, but I just thought it was a lot of twaddle. But anyway, whatever.
It could have been a 45-minute episode of Star Trek.
Yeah, well, it was just like, it just took so long getting to where it needed to get. And when it got there, you know, it was like, I felt like everybody in the theater was sitting there scratching their head going, what the hell was he going on about? You know, it was just. Yeah, but anyway, the one thing I wanted to talk about that I think we might cover in the future is a buddy of mine back in Canada, my good old pal, the Hippy Dippy Weatherman, he recommended a film to me that I had never heard of, and we're always bouncing back and forth off each other with weird little obscure nuggets, and he laid this title on me, this film called Zachariah. Have you guys ever heard of this?
No.
Yeah, I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's a film from 71, and actually it's the debut film of Don Johnson. But it's like this psychedelic musical western, and it's got, you know, Country Joe and the Fish in it, and it's also got the James Gang and Elvin Jones and Doug Kershaw and a bunch of people. And it's this really weird, freaky, like little, it's almost like Dylan's Billy the Kid, but more musical, more trippy and psychedelic. It's really neat film, little film. It's fun. But aside from that, and the other one I saw that I had mentioned to Morris when we were just chewing the fat during the week was that I saw the Atlantic Story, the house that Ahmed built about Ahmed Erdogan. Holy shit, man! Look. I mean, I knew how influential the guy was. I mean, obviously, you know, every picture you saw in the 70s of Zeppelin, Ahmed was there. And I mean, you know, but going beyond that, when you look at how his father was like a Turkish ambassador and this kid's like, you know, basically like, you know, skipping school and ditching all these dignitaries to wind up going down to Harlem and sitting in all these jazz clubs when he's like 16 years old, puffing on doobies and drinking gin. And it's just unbelievable how they bring all these people into the fold, like Ray Charles and Aretha and Otis Redding and all. Like, it's just insane how many people that they were able, like one guy actually was able to just pull into Atlantic, right? And I think that the difference to me, which is amazing, between, you know, what Ahmed did and a lot of other producers did was that it's like Aretha says, like she was on other labels where she had heard somebody's name, but she had never even seen them face to face. Whereas Ahmed was in the studio making the music with the artist. He was sitting there the whole time as part of the process, right? He wasn't just a guy who basically put a signature on a check. He was a dude who was actually there. He wrote music. I mean, like a lot of the stuff that came out, he basically was afraid at first when Atlantic came out that, you know, the label wasn't going to take off. So he basically put his name backwards on all the writing credits because he still thought he could kind of, you know, if this all went to shit, everything went south, he could still wind up becoming a diplomat like his old man was, right? So, yeah, it's an amazing documentary. I mean, just for the historical footage and everything. And, you know, it's hosted by Bette Midler, you know, who I could give a squirt for, but, you know, but still, I mean, it's a really good documentary. And what's really sad is that they had no idea that, you know, Ahmed was on his way out when they finished it, you know. But there's interviews with him and, I mean, with everybody, him and Ray Charles and him and Aretha and, you know, him and what's his name from Island Records, Chris Blackwell, like everybody, man. It's unbelievable. It's really, really, really good, you know.
Sounds like a real treat. Look forward to hopefully getting a chance to see that. Possibly our Australian Centre for the Moving Image, ACME. It sounds like the sort of film that they'd get in. They got in the Muscle Shoals documentary at the beginning of the year. They often sort of like do a two-week season of music documentaries down there, so.
Right.
Yeah, right. They might get it in sometime next year.
And a quick one I just want to throw in there, and I'll just keep it really short, is I finally saw the new Nick Cave film, 20,000 Days on Earth.
Oh, good.
And I fucking loved it. I loved it. It was great. Because it's not actually a documentary. It's a pseudo-documentary where they set things up. But, I mean, you get enough of a feel of who Nick Cave is. He's not laying it on. I mean, it's just like he really didn't want to do a straight documentary, you know, sitting down almost like a David Frost interview type thing. He didn't want to do any of that shit. But in this film, he talks about the creative process and talks about, you know, memories and his fear of forgetting, losing his memory and all these different things that you really get a feel of who Nick Cave really is. I mean, it's a really fantastic film. I really highly recommend it. I mean, if you're not a fan, you'd think he's probably up his own ass with this. But if you really respect him and you enjoy what he does, it's a treat. And you see live covers with the band, like live performances of some of the stuff of the last album. It's really good.
Yeah, looking forward to seeing that one that did have a cinema run here and unfortunately didn't get round to it, but it'll probably end up on DVD or Blu-ray before too long.
Same right. With me. There was a showing at local art house cinema that we go to quite often, but it was literally just one showing and we couldn't make it. So, DVD, Blu-ray's the way on that one, I think.
Mm. Mm-hmm. All right. Just a quick thing I'll mention. I got a chance to watch this weekend a documentary I'd wanted to watch for a long time, and I know that, you know, quite a few people were quite enamored with it, and it's Good Old Frida, about Frida Kelly, who was the secretary originally for the Beatles fan club and then found herself working directly for the Beatles as their secretary. She was employed by Brian Epstein. And it's, I mean, look, basically the film, it tells the Beatles story, but from a different perspective. It's her memories of what happened and her little things about how she saw her employers. And it's just a really lovely, gentle little film. It wasn't sort of going into any of the dark areas. Maybe, you know, just a little bit towards the back end of the story. But it was just really nice to get her side of the story. She's just, you know, this, I don't know, I think she might have been 17 years old or something like that when she met the Beatles. You know, she'd gone, like many other girls, to see them perform at the Cavern, and she was already sort of working a secretarial job somewhere dull, but she sort of found the courage to go speak with them, and then the next thing she knows, Brian Epstein is hiring her to work at his family store, NEMS, and also as the fan club secretary she gets pulled into, and she was there like right from the beginning, and you know, she was there like I think 1 or 2 years after the official split up. So you know, she'd resisted many calls to write a biography or to do a tell-all sort of story. It was just a very gentle film, and really, really enjoyed it. Really lovely story. I don't know whether have any of you guys seen it?
Yes, I enjoyed it. I thought she was very endearing. I thought it was a feel-good kind of thing.
Same here. That's why I liked it. You know, just because.
Yeah, it wasn't dramatic. It was just heartfelt. It was. Yeah, I liked it.
I don't know if any of you did you read. There was the biography from from the '80s, written by I think one of their press officers, Peter Brown, and that was pretty sordid, and didn't really tell a whole lot of nice things. It was. I mean, okay, there's a real story and all that, but it's one man's word, and there were all sorts of things which I thought, I want to bury my head in the sand. I don't want to know that. So I'm sort of glad that this was a lot more gentle, and it wasn't about, how they got into legal hassles and how they were slinging shit at each other. It was just, her telling her relationship with her employers and how they're all good to her, and the things that she got to see. They'd say, come on, Frida, come out on the balcony while we look at the 200,000 fans waving at us upon our return to Liverpool after our first visit to the United States. And it was just, she was still at whatever age she is at now, I think in her late 60s, sort of viewing this with a sense of wonder. It was just really nice to get that perspective. So, yeah, if you haven't seen that film, Good Old Frida, I'd highly recommend it. I don't know if it ever had a cinema run, maybe some festival run or something like that, but it's now, I think, easily available on DVD.
It's on Netflix Instant right now.
All right. Anyway, we've spoken about recent events from us. I hope that you listeners out there enjoyed catching up with us. And, well, now we're going to have a quick break, and then we'll get into the business of hand, talking about Suburbia, directed by Penelope Spheris from 1984. You're listening to See Here. We'll be back in a moment.
Meet the kids from Suburbia. There's Jack.
Wake up and smell the coffee, man.
Sheila.
Just ask them if scars are ready.
Joe.
That could be there all your life.
And Ethan.
I feel kind of scared.
You'll love them. Or hate them.
Metal rejects running wild in our street.
Welcome, Dano.
Their music.
Now give a goddamn applause.
We're talking about kids. Kids like yours and mine.
Well, I'm damn sure they aren't my kids.
Their home.
This is the best home any of us ever had. Besides, if we didn't have each other, we wouldn't have anything.
And nobody's gonna take it away from them.
You shut up!
You molested your own daughter, you scumbag.
Hasta luego, shitface.
A new movie about a new generation. Suburbia.
And we're back from break. Thank you for continuing to listen to episode 11 of the See Here podcast. Much appreciated. And just in case this is your first time listening to the podcast, what we do is we discuss music-related films. Although this is going to be an interesting topic of debate today, because Bernie Sticky has gone and picked today's film, Suburbia, directed by Penelope Spheris. And I'm going to be asking you the question, is this a music-related film? But we'll get to that shortly. First of all, Sticky, why did you pick this film, and what's your connection to it? How long have you been a fan of it? Or, let's presume you're a fan of it. How long have you been aware of the film?
Like a lot of films which seems to have affected me in my teenage years, I came across this one night on a TV channel here in the UK called Channel 4. And basically, we're such a backwater little country that we'd only had three TV channels up until 1982. Channel 4 then started, and it was kind of the sort of artsy upstart kind of TV channel. They showed a lot of dramas and other things that might have been a little, I don't know, incendiary is a bit too strong a word, but certainly they were trying to, you know, make a name for themselves. And after a few years, it would have probably been 85, 86, they showed this one night, and obviously pre-internet days, I'd never heard of this. To be honest, at the time, punk kind of scared me. I was like this little, being like 14, 15 year old goth kid. Which is, yeah, no pictures, luckily. But yeah, there was something about punk, and particularly the American kind of hardcore type punk, which just seemed way too real and scary for me. And certainly at the time, seeing this, this kind of really fed into that idea. I mean, looking at it now, I'm not entirely sure if it's the case. I don't know how realistic certain aspects of it are, but certainly at the time it was, I don't know, it was a gateway into this other world, which I found kind of fascinating and a bit scary at the same time. And it really stuck with me. I didn't see it for years and years, and then I think I bought it on DVD maybe about like 8-9 years ago, and revisited it, and didn't have the same reaction to it, but still really like it. And I look to recommend it, I think. Very interesting film. So, yeah, that's kind of how I came to it. So
when I started watching this, I've got like a bunch of notes written saying like, oh, this reminds me of this film and that bit reminds me of that film. But just as an overall sort of thing, before we sort of get into talking about, you know, specific aspects, the film...
Like, it's funny because it reminds me of Bernie's other pick, was the reggae film.
That is exactly what I was going to say. It reminds me of Babylon.
There you go.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I've got a thing about these kind of youth cults, haven't I guess.
I was going to say, do you have a thing about young kids who are trying to find their own voice, trying to make the breakaway from their parents' generation?
Do you know, I think what it is I'm going to, you know, a bit of self-examination here. I'm on the psychiatrist chair, but I've always been one of those... people who were just, I've always felt like I didn't fit in, no matter what my sort of peer group or whatever was, and I always felt like a bit of an outcast. And, you know, this and Babylon, you know, it's that kind of thing, isn't it? It's people who aren't part of the norm, people who sort of come together because they don't feel part of the norm. And I think in a sort of romantic way, I always felt I was a bit like that myself, so I guess that's why I'm drawn to stuff like this.
I think you can throw the Stains in there too with this.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's that's the film that really I got that was a connection to was the Stains, and just about finding your way and not having it turn out the way you thought it would, and
absolutely,
you know, and,
yeah, yeah. Reminds me a little as well of not a musical film as such, but it reminds me a bit of Dennis Hopper's Out of the Blue as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely, for sure, for sure.
So yeah.
I was going to say that even though in some ways it seems like a million miles away, maybe it's not thematically. Penelope Spheeris's, well, I'm guessing her most famous two films, you know, the Wayne's World one and two films.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in some ways it's in a long way. You know, one's comedy, one's, you know, complete drama, and you know, it's sort of, I guess, you know, the Wayne's World films, you know, there's a lot of satire and that sort of things. But you know, at the heart of it, both films are about youth trying to break away from their parents' expectations, even if, of course, in Wayne's World, the youth are played by, you know, 30-year-old men, but still.
Well, if you look at her filmography, it's, you know, it's kind of studded with films with that similar theme. Obviously, she did the Decline of Western Civilization films, but also The Boys Next Door and Dudes. I don't know if you've ever seen either of those.
Oh, yeah.
Anyone?
I know Eric Reanimator is a big, big fan of Dudes.
Yeah, that's an odd movie. It's the tone in that is really strange. It doesn't know whether it's a comedy or a thriller or what it is, but it's interesting. And again, it's, you know, it's a couple of punk dudes having an adventure. So yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about what the summary of the film. The story of the film. So Suburbia covers the story of a group of punks who squat in an old abandoned house together. They're called TR, which stands for the Rejected, because they've been rejected by society at large and their family, or at least they feel they have. So who wants to start off with their thoughts, you know, story-wise, or anything they want to cover.
Well, I think it's sorry, I'll jump in if nobody minds. It's weird because story-wise, it doesn't have much of a narrative kind of thread through it. I mean, it goes from point A to point B at the end, but apparently Penelope Spheeris used a lot of actual young kids who were non-actors to give it a sense of authenticity, and you can totally see that because, you know, some of the acting is pretty poor. But I think it's really, and again, you know, Wendy and Tim, you can tell me if I'm wrong with this, but it really seems to sum up and be about that sort of generation of kids, post-baby boomer, who grew up in the 70s, into the 80s, into the Reagan era. You know, the dream was crumbling. It was shit. You know, the fact that they live in this abandoned house, which is on a whole fucking, like, almost a state of abandoned houses. And, you know, you just see the squalor and the, I don't know, just the kind of black underbelly of what, you know, what was being presented as Reagan's
America. I was going to say that, you know, in the 1950s, you know, you had Lassie and the nuclear family, but now Lassie's gone rabid and you've got all this pack of
wild dogs. You've got the radioactive family. Yeah.
That's such right. A and great point.
You've got the wild dogs that are just kind of like, you know, like I say, pissing all over the image of Lassie and everything, you know. And
sorry, I was going to say, this is totally the flip side. If you think of movies like E.T. And those right. sort of early 80s big blockbusters that were kind of set in suburbia and showed it as this, you know, kind of beautiful place where everyone got along and it was fantastic. And, you know, this is probably a lot closer to what suburbia was actually like. This is, you know, the flip side of that coin.
Sure.
So before it became trendy to show films about the dysfunctional family, this is probably an early dysfunctional family film.
Well, you know, one thing I got out of this, too, is are you guys familiar with the author S.E. Hinton?
Oh, yeah.
The Outsiders.
Yeah.
Right. Well, this totally, you know, to me felt like an extension of what Hinton was getting at. I mean, because even going back further, you know, generationally, like you look at, you know, the disenfranchised and the dark side of town or the wrong side of the tracks or those kids that were kind of like the collateral damage, you know, of progress and capitalism, you know, that's what these kids are. And, you know,
that's exactly
what's really,
I wouldn't necessarily say that this is not like an early film about kids who are disenfranchised, but I see that this group of kids have banded together as a family, and that's possibly what separates it from a lot of what may have come before. I mean, I don't pretend to sort of like know a whole lot of what's come before in that regard, but this may be an early example of sort of like a metaphor for family, another film that we're going to refer to later on, no doubt.
Well, you know, what's really funny is, like, Bernie, how you were saying earlier about how, you know, you were a goth kid and that, you know, you really, you know, this was kind of something that you weren't really familiar with. I mean, you know, from my own experience, you know, I was big into metal. And then, you know, coming from a small town, we actually had our own family of extended family of kids from different high schools. And we had bush parties and or we'd have house parties, basement parties, and everybody would be playing all kinds of shit. Like somebody would be playing, you know, like Motley Crue, and then somebody would be playing The Exploited or Black Flag, and then somebody would be playing Cyndi Lauper or whatever. And, you know, it was right across the board. But then, you know, the more I got into like more aggressive music and that, and I got to hang out with people who were, you know, kind of beyond just, you know, hairstyles and attitudes. You know, we'd go into Toronto and we'd go to see shows, and then, you know, you'd have to wait until 6 a.m. the next morning to catch a bus home, you know, the Greyhound bus, because buses didn't run at night. So then there's these group of guys, there's this band called The Bunch of Fucking Goofs, and they actually had a house. Well, it was a warehouse and it was called Fort Goof. And, that's where, you know, they would have, like, people would hang out after shows. They'd put up bands there. They'd play there because they were a band. They had dogs there, like their own dogs. So, I mean, watching this film was just kind of like, you know, yeah, I know what this is, you know, like I've seen this. This wasn't just something that Spheeris thought of you know, that would make an interesting movie.
I kind of figured, actually, Tim, that you would kind of relate to this in that way. So, that's interesting you say that, yeah.
As a teenager in the Philly hardcore scene, and of course we had houses like that too, you know? Anarchist collective houses and all that shit. I fucking hated those people because they were never clean. But anyway.
No, like, and you know, this is one thing I wanted to...
You can have my deals and do the damn dishes, people.
Oh, right. Jesus. Well, that's just it. I mean, like, you just reminded me of something funny, Wendy, that was hilarious. Is one time, I remember going to this squat in Toronto, and somebody having a pair of shit-stained tighty-whities nailed to a wall, like, tacked to a wall, right? And then everybody said, hey, man, come on, it's Christmas, you know? Like, do something about that shit. So they went and actually took a picture frame and put it around the shit-stained tighty-whities with Christmas lights around it.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just, you know, the one thing I was going to say, though, like, about this film, I think, the initial theme of what's going on here is this idea that as much as you think there's unity and they bond together, they're still segregated. They still reject things amongst themselves. Like the group is called the Rejected, but they actually are very different amongst themselves. And there are things that they don't jibe with amongst their own collective. And I mean, I think that's really interesting.
Now, is that because of the kind of punk ethos and the fact that it was about, you know, fuck everything and be yourself? Or was that just because of who they were as people?
I think it was who they were as people because, yeah. I mean, you know, like the idea, for example, like, you know, I knew people that were druggy punks. I knew people that were straight edge punks. I knew people that were like political anarcho punks that were more, you know, intellectuals. I mean, there was all kinds of variations of people, just like there's all kinds of variations of any people. And I mean, you know, that's the irony is that, you know, you have, you know, the straights in this film or the general society looking at these kids saying, look at all these fucking haircuts. Look at all these fucking ripped up shirts and jackets and shit. What the fuck are you guys on about? But meanwhile, they're all very different. Because, you know, you've got Jack, who's, you know, kind of the leader of them all, and Jack's kind of the smart ass, and he's this very dry, he's got this dry sense of humor, and, you know, and then you've got the skinhead dude, I forget his name, and he's got a real short fuse, and, right. You know, he's just more of an id. And then you've got, you know, our protagonist that comes in, and he's the kid that, you know, basically he's fed up with his mother being an alcoholic and he just can't handle it anymore. And, you know, and then he goes to a show and you've got this, druggy kid who's part of the TR, and he winds up dosing this kid and putting shit in his cup. And that's how he winds up being initiated into the fold, is that Jack actually finds him laying out on the grass, covered in puke, and says, hey, kid, you can't be laying out on the grass here, man. Like, come on with us, you know? And Jack kind of takes him away, and it's almost like Jack's like this Peter Pan, like, come on to Neverland. Like, you know, we'll take you back to Neverland Ranch, you know?
Lock heaven, hold back the tears. Your love runs loose in the wilderness. Our silence pushes me under. Soft whispering from the dark of your love to me. Like sunset, your love falls. Ash night towns filled to your lurid love. In darkness, I know you. The sunlight showers my rain. Your movements obscure me. Your laughter, so lurid.
Well, see, here's the way how I sort of looked at the film, and that's a really good example there. He's doing something. On the surface, you can sort of see it as, come be one of our gang, be one of our crew, and yet I see him sort of doing something in a very parental sort of way. And there's all these moments in the film where, like, okay, so the common conception of punks or any group who set out to do something different from, you know, the straights or society or whatever it might be, but yet there's so many moments in this film where they're doing things just in a different way to their parents' generation. There was this moment in the film whereby I've forgotten the main protagonist who we see get into the gang, and then he brings in his little brother.
So it's right. Evan, isn't it? Is it Evan?
Evan, that's right.
Yeah.
And Evan, you know, he's He's there. He just thinks this is all a bit of a lark. This is all a bit fun. And then the girl who's the runaway, she's reading him like a bedtime story. And then those two other punk girls come in and they say, just because he's asleep doesn't mean you should stop. Read it to us. Read it to us. There's all these things about the family. So they want the unity of family. They want to reject their parents' generation for certain things, and yet they want what their parents gave them. They're still used to what their parents gave them. And
they also still carry on a lot of the negative trends from the last generation. Like, for example, I laughed at the bit where, you know, Jack's talking about his dad being a cop. He goes, yeah, my stepdad's a cop, man, and he fought in Vietnam. But that's not the worst of it. He's black.
Yeah, yeah. They got the same. Well, they got the same prejudices. What was that other character, right. Joe Schmo, leaves? Right. He says he left home because his father was gay.
Right.
So,
right.
What I like here in the film is that it's not one of those things where the whole parents' generation is fucked up, and it's the future is our kids. No, the kids are, you know, in some ways. I mean, even though they want us to give us their sympathy. Our sympathy. They're, a lot of what they do and say is pretty fucked up too, and they certainly some redeemable traits. Yeah. But there's a whole.
You know what it is? It's like a poison filtered through generations. You know, where it's not completely, you know, poison free. I mean, it's just a diluted poison. If that makes sense.
Well, we're kind of all like that. We've all got our issues that we've, you know, taken from our parents, that they've taken from their parents.
Right, but that's what I mean.
And
it's diluted.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's diluted.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that they present this in a movie. Yeah, because like a lot of the time the movie says, right, it's going to be black and white, and parents' generation is screwed up, and the kids are all good. Spheeris and Roger Corman have gone and said, well, no, really, everyone's, you know, at least a little bit fucked up. And I really like how they've gone and taken that attitude.
Right.
I was going to say, when going back to what you were talking about, the kind of idea of family in this, and how, you know, the kids' parents aren't necessarily super fucked up or are fucked up or whatever. I think the idea of the group living together in the house and the family that they sort of established there, it's kind of the family that they wanted, if you see what I mean. It's not the family they have because, you know, Jennifer's getting beaten, Sheila's being beaten, and Evan's mum is an alcoholic, and, you know, Jack's dad is a black Vietnam vet cop. So, you know, they want the kind of, I guess they want the ideal, they want what they've been promised, but reality hasn't delivered that, and so, you know, they try and make their own version of it.
Right.
Perhaps, I don't know, am I talking shit? I don't know.
Well, you know, I saw this movie... I remember I had found it on VHS like years and years ago because I was interested in the fact that Flea was in it. You know, that was in high school, that was my main reason for wanting to watch this movie. And then I completely wiped it from my memory. And then to watch it this time, I inadvertently watched half an hour of the Richard Linklater film Suburbia. And I was completely confused. So I'm going on this movie by my vague, half memories.
Oh, so you didn't watch it again for...
No, I couldn't find it online.
Well,
I mean, Freeman Bale.
What did you like most about this film?
Well, I mean, I remember at the time that I saw it, of course, I was very, very much into that idea of like, yeah, banding together and living in a burned out house and, you know, all this stuff. But it's funny because after being into, you know, after like being in the punk scene and being in hardcore bands and stuff, like I fucking, as an adult, I hate that idea. Like I hate that whole, like, that whole grubby lifestyle thing.
But it's such a teenage thing to do though, isn't it?
Oh,
I mean, no self-respecting adult would be living
absolutely.
Like that, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. So this movie really, really does, like, yeah, it totally does embody that certain teenage mentality very, very well. It does embody a whole certain point in time very, very well, and that whole sort of like getting away from your abusive scenario. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
We're Pat Brown. Try to run the cops down, Pat Brown. Grab it into the ground, Pat Brown. Try to run the cops down, Pat Brown. Grab it into the ground, Patrick Edward Brown. Try to run.
one thing I wanted to say that I think is kind of funny, tell me if I'm wrong here, but I really think that it's kind of like, you know, the image of the dogs to me is very interesting, because it's like, you know, this idea that they don't want to follow the path that their parents followed, but they want to be free like a dog, you know, they want to be able to run where they want to run and run in the pack, but actually they wind up following, you know, being held on a tighter leash. And I think that, you know, it's like we were saying earlier, you sometimes unintentionally ape those of the past generations, you know, and I think that a lot of the actions that, you know, they kind of portray, a lot of the things that they go through are a lot of things that are indicative of where they come from.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I just wanted to come back to the earlier point, see what if you guys thought. Remember when I mentioned about the reading of the bedtime story, it brought back to me Boogie Nights, because there's that same thing about Roller Girl wanting to look at Amber Waves as her mommy. Oh, can I call you mommy?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you get these sort of fucked up, you know, pseudo family. You know, it's that desire, that craving for family so much. Yeah.
Right. Sure.
And I guess damaged people have a way of kind of finding each other as well, don't they?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
When they've got that, you know, those not necessarily the same damages, but when they've got things like that in common, when they're broken.
Right.
You know, it's
speaking of broken, damaged people, the one thing that I was going to say that I didn't want to forget, Morris, was the beginning of this film actually kind of reminds me of Australia. Dingoes ate my baby.
A dingo ate my baby. Oh, really? You know, Meryl Streep can do many accents, but it sounded more a South African accent to me than an Australian accent. So.
Right.
So you know that this dog attack at the start of the film was apparently real. Apparently, Penelope Spheeris got a lot of the ideas that she used in this film from just reading newspaper reports in the sort of LA kind of area during that sort of period. And apparently that dog attack did happen, and there were packs of wild dogs roaming around. So
I got to tell you, that stressed me out, the beginning of the film. For those of you who haven't
it's
seen
it, it's pretty brutal, isn't it?
The opening scene has one of the main characters in the film, Sheila, running away from home, and she, you know, hitches a ride by the side of the freeway and gets into a car with this lady and her young son. The car gets a flat tire, so she goes off to make a phone call by the phone box, and the young boy, she leaves him untended for a second and is attacked by this wild dog that we find out later on in the film is one of the pets roaming around on the property of the rejected headquarters. But before we know that, it's just absolutely stressful, and we're sort of thinking,
it's horrible,
needed?
Isn't it?
Ugh, yuck. One thing that we haven't discussed yet is, okay, so we've gone and, you know, spoken a little bit about this bonding between this group of kids who've all run away from home and they've gone and, you know, made their own dysfunctional family. But the other main group in the film is, you know, what I think the phrase you used before, Bernie, was, you know, the straights. But, you know, it's the rest of society, those representing, you know, the wider society, in a group calling itself Citizens Against Crime. Now, they're everything that you'd expect in a movie featuring a group calling them citizens against something, you know, whatever it is. Citizens against fish, citizens against swimming pools, citizens against long hair, citizens against instant karma, you know, whatever you want to call it. Here it's Citizens Against Crime. In particular, we see things through these two rednecks, one called Jim and one called Bob. Particularly unique names for rednecks in a film, I thought. And they're at this meeting where they're speaking in the presence of the stepfather of one of the rejected, the black cop who he refers to. And he's possibly the only sympathetic adult in the film. And so they're basically sort of saying, well, our brand of vigilantism is much better than your brand of law, because, you know, we can get things done and you can't get things done. I don't know why I'm sounding like one of the characters out of Deliverance, but that's my Australian impression of rednecks, just as, you know, Meryl Streep is your impression of what an Australian sounds like. And it sort of reminded me of this issue of Mad magazine that I read years ago, where there were this bunch of guys coming out of a porno cinema, and one of them was reading a Hustler magazine and saying, "It's disgraceful, the president of the USA in that magazine." You know, the irony there. And there's this great line between Jim or Bob or Jim or whatever they called each other, when they're in the strip club, and one of them says to the other one, "Well, I'm not a religious fella, but I just think that what those rejected punks are doing is sinful." It just sort of embodies everything that the rejected are that they're rejecting.
It's that's not a subtle moment, is it?
No, but
when he says that.
And actually, just that brings me to one other point I wanted to make, is that this could have really quite easily been a bit of a shoegaze film. It could have been something about, you know, this group of kids who they're living this life that's, you know, it's pretty hard on them, and we're supposed to have this sympathy for them, but not much happens. But being a Roger Corman film, something happens every few minutes. And there's really quite a lot of exciting things that happen, you know, where they're going around raiding garages to get food, or where there's an attack between the citizens against crime, committing crime by invading the rejected's house and threatening them, or something happening in the punk club. There's always something that's, you know, regardless of whether it's pleasant to watch or not, there's some things that are pretty hard going in the film. But there's always something pretty exciting going on, being a Roger Corman film.
I think that raises an interesting point. Do you guys think that you would class this as an exploitation film? Or is the idea of these kids and the punk thing, you know, is Corman just making an exploitation film here? Corman, obviously, Spheris, you know, based on some sort of current trend or whatever. And because, like you say, he does spice it up by throwing in the sort of action and violence and so on. So would you class it as exploitation, or does it kind of rise above that?
I definitely think it rises above it. There was a film that I watched a few weeks ago, and of course, because we're talking now, I can't remember the name of it, but Terry Frost reviewed it on Paleo Cinema, and it was a Roger Corman-directed film from, I think, 1962, starred William Shatner, and he was a guy who came to this small town America to cause
The Intruder, isn't
that's
it?
That's the one, The Intruder.
Yes, yeah.
Absolutely. I'm giving the game away. That is going to be like in my top 10 films for the year. I loved this. Well, top 10 first-time watchers for the year. I absolutely love this film. And according to, you know, Terry, he was saying that, you know, Corman wanted to make more films, maybe he thought Corman should have made more films that weren't just out to sort of be regular drive-in fare, and he had something to say there. And I think that Suburbia is his something to say. Obviously, okay, the punk thing was, I don't know how big it was, but it was in the news. So he thought, I'll use this model to have something to say about disaffected youth, because they obviously are. And whether you sympathize with them or not is not the point. He wanted to have something to say about disaffected youth, and he didn't paint them out to be angels, because they weren't. And I think he treated the subject matter with, you know, with some level of seriousness. So no, I don't think that this was an exploitation film. No, I definitely think he treated the subject matter really very, very well.
This wasn't like the Quincy Punk episode, you know?
No.
Yeah, it wasn't that sort of punk exploitation, like, oh, look at how crazy these people are.
But I think that it's half and half, in my opinion, because I think that, you know, for a lot of people that never really had exposure to the whole punk scene, it, you know, it's an eye opener for those people. But for people that are in the scene, it's just like, yeah, what's the point? You know, like, I don't see anything wrong with this, you know? I think it's half and half, and it's not like, you know, Wendy says, it's not the Quincy Punk episode, sure. But I think that for a lot of people that have never really, you know, experienced the punk scene, they watch this and kind of go like, whoa, really? Like, you live like that? Like, wow, you know? So I think it's a little bit of both.
Right.
I remember.
he's gone. And I never read my visit. Read my visit.
I'm going to throw this question to Bernie. We are a music film podcast, and thus far we haven't really discussed anything particularly music-related. Do you think that this is a music film? I mean, we do get three scenes of the TR group in punk clubs, and we do get performances by one by a group called D.I., one group by...
Yeah, D.I., Richard hung himself.
Yep, another group called
the
True
Vandals,
Sounds of Liberty.
And yeah, TSOL, True Sounds of Liberty, yeah.
All right, so
yeah,
let me ask
the Vandals,
this.
Yeah.
So look, you know, me as not someone who sort of grew up with the punk thing, so what's the history of these bands in a nutshell? Do you know much
Tim
about the background
know
of it?
More about these. I'm fairly au fait with American punk of this period, but to be honest, not these not three bands. Actually, okay. Tim could probably tell you.
TSOL, this is before they got all keyboardy and weird, you know?
Well, what's really funny is at the beginning, you know, like the L.A., California, L.A. scene, there it really wasn't hardcore. I mean, the one thing that I think is very interesting about the California punk scene when it started was that it was so diverse. I mean, like, you had bands like The Germs, and you had Crime and X, you know, and you had, you know, like... The Dickies later on, like you had all these bands that were so very, very different. I mean, even in the film, I mean, when you see TSOL, they're almost more like a new wave band, like a gothy.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, they're very new wave in this, aren't they?
Right, with keyboards and everything. And I mean, today, because of everything we've gone through, you know, with punk, younger kids today will watch this and go, this isn't fucking punk. What are you talking about, man? Like, come on, you know, like, but it was. I mean, this is where everything derived from, you know?
Well, this seems more genuinely punk to me than, I don't know, The Offspring or some.
Right.
Well, yeah.
Sure.
I think we've had this discussion on the podcast before, though, about what the definition of punk was. And, you know, punk was not necessarily about... the common conception of something like, you know, the Sex Pistols or the Clash. I mean, that was obviously part of it, but punk has come to mean something more about doing things differently from the accepted norm. And I think while we're discussing on the episode about Heartworn Highway, discussing, you know, that sort of the alternative country movement got started by these guys who were in their way, that was punk because they were doing stuff different to the Nashville scene. So, any of these young snotty kids nowadays saying, that's not punk, point them to Heartworn Highways and say, no, son, this is punk. It's all punk.
Going back to your question, Morris, about whether this is a music-related film, I mean, I would say emphatically yes. Even if you didn't have the musical performances in it, which, as you say, there's three in there, and, you know, they're all pretty good, and it looks like they were, I don't know if... I imagine they were actually playing live. It certainly looked like it. But I think punk, again, you know, from what you were just saying, everybody has their own definition of it. But I think the one thing which everyone would agree on is that certainly in the beginning, it was about the music, and this whole kind of culture which developed from that, you know, kind of wouldn't exist without that music in the first place.
Right.
So without punk, you wouldn't have this gang of kids hanging around in this house together. Do you know what I mean? That's sort of my take on it. So,
well,
I think in that
respect,
it definitely is.
What's really funny is that, you know, the music is indicative of what you were talking about in the past. You know, you were saying about this idea of these kids had an ideal of what they wanted as a family, and they couldn't achieve that ideal, but they kind of created what they could. And I think that's the same thing with punk music, you know, with the whole scene.
Absolutely.
Was that initially, you know, I think a lot of these artists, they had this kind of image of what they wanted to do. And then, you know, maybe they could. And what's really funny is that can even go down base level as being able to play, you know.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely.
And then it gets into this thing where, you know, they do what they can as opposed to doing what they want to do, you know.
I was going to say is, you know, that's totally the ethos of punk, isn't it? It's do it yourself. It's you don't like what you're surrounded by, then you create your own kind of reality. You make your own music, you make your own lifestyle.
Well, Well, there's the scene when, you know, not to give away any spoilers, but when, you know, they're given the bottom line by Jack's dad that they've got to vacate, and the skinhead dude, he's just like, you know, yeah, your old man just thinks we can't take care of ourselves. Nobody thinks we can take care of ourselves. Fuck these people. We're going to stick around, man. We're not going anywhere, you know? Like,
yeah.
And there's that, you know, they're looking at the larger scale society and thinking that the larger scale society is condemning them. They're thinking that they can't function on their own, and they're going to function by their own accord. You know, they're going to function by their own beliefs and what's important to them.
So in some ways, despite the fact that this is dated by its look, it's still thematically very relevant though, isn't it?
Oh shit. Yeah, man. I mean, like, I would put this film, I'm not kidding. I would put this film on a double bill with Rebel Without a Cause.
Hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Sure, for sure. I mean, yeah. You know, it's just, I could easily see one of the kids in this film just saying, "You're tearing me apart." You know, like, I can just, you can see that, man. It's just clear as, you know, hand in front of my face.
It's, yeah, it's still relevant now, and it will still be relevant in decades to come because, you know, whatever the next youth culture is, whatever ways teenagers finally rebel against their parents, and, you know, there's always going to be broken people, unfortunately.
Well,
and it's,
well, it goes, it's not even the broken. What I think happens is that, you know, it goes back to, like, you know, things that are go beyond Western culture. I mean, like, you look at, you know, in Africa, the tribal, the village as the family, right? Like, you look at these, you know, like, so many different cultures where, you know, if your father dies or your mother dies, you're still one of us. We'll still take you on, you know, like, you know, you still have a family, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's weird in North America that we had our own families, but yet, you know, the idea of the village, the tribal family was, you know, just really kind of strange or kind of, you know, odd notion. But meanwhile, around the world and other parts, you know, that's the way it's always been.
All right. Are there any final thoughts?
I'd just like to say my favorite line of dialogue in the film. As I say, the acting isn't great, to be perfectly honest, but a lot of the characters do deliver their lines with conviction. And there is a point where Skinner, the skinhead dude, who, you know, he's got his, like, combat trousers and his boots on.
Yeah.
And this redneck guy says to him, "Where's the war?" And he looks at him and he says, "Up your ass." Which is, you know, perfect comeback, man. Snappy answer to a stupid question.
Right.
It's perfect. And it does, again, it's got the, again, without giving anything away, but it does have that kind of early 80s downbeat ending. Nobody comes out a winner, do they?
Well, actually, it made me think, and I don't want to give it away once again because it might, people might be able to guess it, but it reminded me of a classic 1950s musical. We'll discuss it off air.
Sure.
Yeah, but you know,
I think you know which one I'm referring to, right?
Yeah. I was going to say too that if it wasn't for the nudity and other shit like that, I was going to say that it reminded me of, like, a 1970s made-for-TV movie. Like, you know, they always had those American, North American, like, Born Innocent with Linda Blair or, like, some of those. Yeah. A lot of them wound up ending the same way.
Yeah, no, does that ending feel in this, again, without giving anything away, does it feel a little bit tacked on and sensationalist, or does it kind of, you know, organically get to that point and make sense?
It doesn't necessarily feel organic to me, and yet I'm struggling to think, well, not how else they could have ended it, but, oh, look, gosh, I don't think, well, the only thing I will give away is that it doesn't end well. And no matter what they chose, it was never going to end well. Whether it would have not ended well this way, or they would have found something else to do, is debatable, but it was never going to end well, and I think that was inevitable.
Yeah, I don't know, again, just a sign of the times, I guess, the early 80s, that sort of nihilistic, and, you know, well, I don't know, I'm rambling here.
One other point I sort of forgot to make, and this is no big thing, but in terms of two other films, that I thought it reminded me of. There was that one shot where the whole gang are walking towards the camera, and then we see a side profile of them all in slow-mo, and I thought Clockwork Orange, Alex and the
Exactly. Yeah.
And in the scene where they're going around the neighborhood, where they're trying to gather groceries to store at their squat, it reminded me of the Amiga Man, because even though his perception is that he's the last man on Earth, in this bit, in their minds, they're the keepers of the flame. They really are the last people on Earth, because the straights don't count. As far as the straights might as well be the zombies from the Amiga Man. So
it's interesting that you say that, Morris, because those scenes when they are driving around the suburbs, generally they are just pretty deserted, aren't they?
They are. Yeah.
Yeah. They've got that kind of eerie quality to them.
And I love that scene when they're pulling up in Jack's shitbox behind the bus, and the bus is just belching out all that black smoke. And he just says, "Hand me one of those bottles." And you just see him, he just fires at the side of the bus. That's great.
Wendy, do you have a final memory from the last time you watched it?
No, but I'm enjoying listening to you guys. So.
A few other quick things I'll mention. Films, again, in similar in tone and feel. Close to the Edge. The Matt Dillon film from, 79?
Over the Edge.
Over the Edge. I'm sorry, Over the Edge.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And there's a thematic link here. So similar to Over the Edge, similar feel to River's Edge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And the other thing I was going to mention, the incidental music in the film, I found to be very effective and very good and very, evocative of that period. It kind of sounded like the Wipers on Downers or something. So,
reminded me of Repo Man before Repo Man.
Yes, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. I just want to say that this is a real postcard from an era gone by, and it's really funny how the only one that's ever really got any, well, the only two that ever really gained any notoriety out of the film were obviously, Flea from the Chili Peppers and Penelope's Fierce. But, I think one thing too is don't go in expecting, performances from these kids. If you go in just looking at them as kids, then, it's more effective. But if you go in thinking, okay, these are all actors, because I think there's only two of them that were real actors and the rest of them were just kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think if you just go in, with that kind of realization or, understanding, then I think it's a lot more effective.
So all around thumbs up, this is a recommend?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's fantastic. It's a real, as Tim said, it's a postcard from that time. It's really evocative of that period, which, never going to recapture now. It's gone, it's history. But I think in its way, it's a really powerful film. Thumbs up, totally. I love it.
Mm. Yeah, same here. Okay, we're now at the end of the episode where we get to ask the next one in line whose turn it is to pick a film, and that be Wendy. Wendy. So maybe we'll watch a different film to what you select.
If you can find a second film called Beware of Mr. Baker, then go right ahead.
Okay, so that's your choice for December?
Yes, yeah, I'm going to the Ginger Baker documentary. It's easy to find. It's on Netflix Instant. It's, it's very, very, we'll have a good conversation.
A.K.A. Miserable Old Twat.
Hang on. It's
Twat. Hand.
It is Twat, Tim. Come on. Before.
Yeah, we have. Yeah. Get on with the program. Show your allegiance to the Empire.
It'll be entertaining, I'm sure.
Yeah, I've wanted to see this for ages, and I just haven't got around to it. So perfect excuse to watch it now. So that's great. I can't wait to watch this one and talk about it.
Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thanks once again for listening to See Here podcast. Tell your friends we exist if you want to communicate to us. Send us an email. We're at seeherepodcast@gmail.com. Join the Facebook group. We're all very, very approachable. And please, come and make some suggestions. Actually, we spoke about this on the last edition of the show, where what we'd like to do from next year is maybe do, like, every third or fourth show, make it a listener suggestion. basically, you know, we're up for anything. It doesn't have to be a good film. It can be a shit film, and we can spend, you know, an hour talking about why we hated something, or, you know, but it could be something great. But please, you know, make those suggestions either through the Facebook group or email, and we'd love to follow up on it. So, yep, just give it some thought. We'll do something like that for 2015. And if we get any suggestions over the next few weeks, we might make a listener suggestion our first pick of 2015. So we've only got one more film to go for 2014. And then guess what, folks? We're 1 year old. That's just incredible.
Holy shit.
Who'd have sunk
it? Take them training wheels off.
Oh, yeah. We'll be old enough to be out on our own. How about that?
Why?
Well, all right. It's been a lot of fun, and we'll see you sometime in December. And until then, please watch some great films, be they music related or not. Listen to some great music, read some fantastic books, be nice to each other, start a podcast so we can listen to you. It's all very community based, isn't it? It's all good. And we'll see you sometime in December. All right. Cheers, folks.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.